welcome back to Slightly Foxed, and this month, a little detective work. Who was Sylvia Plath? She produced some of the most original writing of the 20th century, and yet all most of us really know about her is that she was married to the poet Ted Hughes and that she killed herself. But of course, Sylvia was infinitely more than a doomed poet, and our guest today has conducted a fingertip search through her life and work and produced a really remarkable book about Sylvia called Red Comet. Heather Clark is a Harvard and Oxford-educated scholar. She's currently Professor of Contemporary Poetry at the University of Huddersfield. She's joining us remotely from New York. I'm in Cambridge myself. That's Cambridge, England, rather than Cambridge, Massachusetts, for our American listeners. And Slightly Foxed, Anna Kirk and Hattie Summers are both in London. Hello, everyone.
Hello there.
Hello.
Heather, thanks so much for being with us. I'm picturing you in a New York loft. Is my picture accurate?
Unfortunately, no. I'm in a suburban house about an hour outside of New York City. But maybe someday.
Yeah, you should have made it up, Heather. We'd never have known the difference.
I know.
Now, you divide your time, don't you, between the US and the north of England?
I do, or I did before the pandemic hit. But I'm hoping to resume my trips back to Yorkshire fairly soon.
Now, look, as I said, I mean, if people know nothing else about Sylvia Plath, they do know she killed herself. And she is usually characterized as either she's a fragile woman who was trampled by society, or she's some crazy person who's obsessed with death. But, you know, obviously you argue she was far more complex than that.
Yes, that cliche of Sylvia Plath was what inspired me to write this biography, because I had studied Plath for many years and I had taught her work when I was an undergraduate professor in Vermont, and I was just tired of this cliche of the hysterical woman writer, the doom and gloom, the witchy death goddess. I was very tired of that image, and I felt like there had been so much really good Plath criticism written by scholars over the past 10 years or so, but it didn't seem to be reaching, I guess what I would call the public imagination, and I just felt like she was more famous for the manner in which she died than she was for her trailblazing poetry and fiction. And so that was sort of the fire that lit this desire I had to write a long and serious biography about her.
It is a long and serious biography. And we have all read it, Heather, I should say. And actually really, really enjoyed reading it, but it's a big read.
You dug
right back from her earliest days, didn't you? And contrary to what we might think, I mean, she was not some antisocial emo. She was clever, she was academic, she was ambitious, even as a teenager.
Absolutely. I spent a lot of time going through her juvenilia, and I was so blown away by the the absolute skill that she had as a poet at 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old. I mean, she mastered iambic pentameter before she was in middle school. She just had this sort of preternatural skill. And they were quite accomplished, these poems. And I felt it was important to tell the reader that she had been kind of following this literary vocation for quite a while. And also that you can see some of her mature themes kind of emerging in her juvenilia. There's a poem that she wrote when she was 13 called A Winter Sunset. And I quote it in the biography. And it's all about sort of the skeletal outline of these winter trees as the sun is setting. And it really makes one think of her masterful poems like Elm or The Moon in the Yew Tree. I think it's fascinating. And it was important to me to spend some time with those early poems. And I knew it was maybe a lot for the reader to to get through, but I was writing what I hoped was a really comprehensive biography.
Well, you know, for what it's worth, it really worked for me, because you set the scene of Sylvia right off the bat as a woman, not a woman I would have recognized from what I knew about her before. She didn't come from an environment where people were writing poetry, did she?
She didn't, but her parents were both intensely literary. You know, her father was an academic, and her mother was a frustrated artist, in a sense. She had actually wanted to become a writer, but she felt like when she married, she had to put all of that aside. And I think she poured a lot of that ambition and drive and love of literature into her daughter.
So she goes to college. And that's both a good thing and a bit of a turning point for her.
Yes, I mean, she she was always worried about money, right? And about paying tuition. And so she received a scholarship from Smith College, which just allowed her to leave her house in Wellesley and to live on campus out in Northampton in Western Massachusetts. She had also been accepted to Wellesley College, but she would have had to live at home, and she didn't want to do that. Because she had shared a bedroom with her mother for nearly her whole life. There was a real complicated relationship there between the two of them. So luckily, she did get enough money from Smith to start there, and she flourished. For the first couple of years, at least, she became the star of the English department. She published her poems in the Smith magazines. She wrote scores of newspaper articles, which we're just beginning to understand how much journalism Sylvia Plath did at Smith. She was writing for all of these local newspapers in Western Massachusetts. Her professors loved her. She was a straight-A student, but she did experience a lot of anxiety about her work and feeling like, you know, she always needed to be the best in the class. And she was very hard on herself. And I think the depression, you know, starts to really show itself at Smith in more obvious ways.
Yeah, I felt a tremendous sympathy for her reading that. Yeah. But of course, it drove her onto good things, didn't it? Because it drove her onto a Fulbright scholarship to Cambridge.
Absolutely. And she had such good relationships with her English professors at Smith. And, you know, she also had an acceptance from Columbia and Radcliffe, but she chose to go to England. She really wanted to go to Cambridge. She always wanted to grow. She was someone who always wanted to enlarge her perspective. She was hungry for whatever life threw at her. She was so hungry for experience, right? She wanted to read more. She wanted to draw more. She wanted to cook more. She wanted these great love affairs. And I just love that about her, this enormous appetite for life, which is so at odds with the cliche of Plath.
Yes. And actually reading, you know, what you say about her at Cambridge, you know, she stands right out, doesn't she? She is tall, physically tall. She's attractive. She is well-dressed, you know, compared to the other students. She looks really sophisticated. People watch her striding down the street and think, wow, who is that?
Several people I interviewed who knew her at Cambridge, they kept bringing that up, her clothes and her presence and her laughter and the bright colors that she favored and the makeup. And some people were sort of saying things like, you know, she was too American and she was almost too flashy, right? Because
yeah, it's not very Cambridge, all that.
yeah. And so, you know, I think she took some flack for that. And a lot of people remembered what they called her gushiness. But I think it's a zest for life that's part of it.
I was just going to say, I think that really shows throughout Red Comet. Throughout all of the letters and diaries, there's a lot of laughter. She definitely is a woman of passions. There's lots of, you know, love of physical activity and nature and mischief. I really love that little note that her favourite word when she was 11 or 12 was fuzz buttons, and that she just, like, that's not really what you think of when you think of Sylvia Plath.
Some silliness as well.
Yes, exactly. She had a great sense of humour. And you see it in her letters. She was very funny. In the Bell Jar, parts of it are laugh out loud funny. She said once that when she read her poem Daddy to a friend out loud, they both just crumbled on the floor laughing.
I find that a bit surprising.
We don't really write letters anymore. People don't really record their lives in the same way as they used to. And I just wondered what you thought that will do to biographies of the future.
Yeah, because for me, the backbone of the biography was the letters. All of the surviving letters were published in 2018. And that was part of the reason I wanted to write the biography when I did, because I knew that all of these letters were in the pipeline about to be published. And it just made my job as a biographer so much easier. I think that biographies will become more dependent upon interviews with peers and that sort of thing.
And that's tricky, isn't it? Subjectivity creeps in a big way, doesn't it?
My sense is that biographies simply won't be as rich without these glorious letters to draw upon, these literary letters.
And just following on from that, Heather, I mean, obviously you had so much material and it's so comprehensive, your biography, but in terms of the things that you left out, what were the reasons for that? Was it in terms of space or due to the narrative flow of the biography or a decision not to expose certain things? I mean, presumably you were aware that people are still alive. Well, some of the people who might be written about are still alive. And what decisions did you make along those lines?
Well, believe it or not, the manuscript was much, much longer than what was eventually published. I cut 300 pages myself before I even submitted it to my editor at Knopf, and then she helped me cut more. Most of the cutting was from the first half of the biography. I had written a lot more about the Dick Norton relationship, Plath and her boyfriend Dick Norton, because I'd read through all of his correspondence, and that was kind of interesting, but, you know, we cut a lot of that, and I would go down a lot of literary critical rabbit holes that my editor would sort of pull me back from and say, well, maybe we don't need 20 pages about this, maybe a paragraph will suffice. There are things I left out of the book to protect people who were still living, and but most of what ended up on the cutting floor was, yeah, from the first half of her life, just because the book was so long. And we wanted to get it under 1,000 pages. That was sort of my editor's demand. And she said, it's fine if it's long, as long as it's readable.
So I think this is the point at which we need to talk about Ted Hughes, don't we? Because I think she was at Cambridge, wasn't she, when she first met him?
She was, yes.
So he's a fellow poet. You know, obviously later he's a British poet laureate. He is clever. He is charismatic. He's a couple of years older, isn't he?
Yes.
And it sounds like she just set eyes on him and that was that. She was really, really immediately drawn to him, wasn't she?
Yes. In her calendar, she wrote mad, passionate abandon after she met him.
That sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it just encapsulates perfectly her response to him, which was totally immediate. She just fell in love with him right away.
I mean, we should say she's no kind of shy wallflower at this point. You know, she's had, she's had relationships before. This is not her first love affair, is it? But it's certainly, it's a grand passion.
As grand as they come.
And for him too.
Yes, for him too, absolutely. This was actually, I think, one of the first things I ever learned about Sylvia Plath. She bit Ted Hughes's cheek.
Yes, at a party.
Yeah, at the party where they met. But I think that action was maybe more calibrated than spontaneous, because I think he sort of became fascinated by this person who would do such a thing. And there was that she was almost this fellow traveler, not interested in leading a traditional life and maybe following the rules. I think later he maybe regretted that action. I don't want to say turned him on, but I mean, some men would say, never again, I'm not going near that person after, you know.
Yeah, I met her and she bit me.
Exactly. But Ted Hughes didn't. You know, Ted Hughes wanted more.
Because he was at the party with someone else, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was with his girlfriend at the time. And yeah, he ended up sort of leaving his current girlfriend and pursuing Plath. And he enlisted his friends to help. You know, he asked one of his friends, I'll find out her address. And they were throwing rocks up at her window at Cambridge. And then this friend said, I'd never seen Ted do anything like this.
Yeah, because I mean, we should say Hughes is enormously charismatic and attractive. I mean, yes. He does not have trouble getting girlfriends. But Sylvia, he didn't want to even take a chance, did he, that she was just going to walk out of that party and that would be that?
Yeah, because he was not living in Cambridge at the time, so he had to really make the effort, right? And, you know, she was someone who, throughout her dating life, had been looking for a man who would respect her literary ambition. And it was really difficult for her to find such a person in 1950s America. She did find someone who sort of fit that bill, her boyfriend Richard Sassoon, who was a French major at Yale. He was someone, I think, who respected her talent, but most of them didn't. And so she was still sort of seeing Richard Sassoon when she met Ted Hughes, and that hadn't quite fizzled out yet. But Sassoon deserted her, as she would have put it, in in Europe, and so she went straight into Hughes's arms from a European trip.
And Hughes did seem, from reading your book, did seem to really take her talent seriously pretty well immediately.
Yeah, I think he did. He saw that she was a genius. He sort of drove her, maybe too hard in the beginning, but he would ask her to read poems out loud, and he had these little exercises for her, which he had for his friends also, by the way. It wasn't this condescending thing where, oh, because she's a woman, I'm going to ask her to do these poetic exercises.
Heather, tell me, so how long is it before they get married? It's not that long, is it?
No, I mean, it's such a whirlwind courtship. They meet in February of 1956, and they marry on June 16th. And they hadn't been sort of seeing each other every day during that time. I mean, part of this was long distance as well. So sort of married on a wing and a prayer. Again, the grand passion. They were just completely seized. And apparently she was the one who asked him to marry her.
Unusual for the time.
Unusual for the time, right. And he just said, well, sure, you know.
And it went really well, didn't it? I mean, in the early days, it's like a dream.
In the early days,
they're working, yes. They're pushing each other. He guided her, would it be fair to say, in the early days, in her literary work?
Yes, you know, I think the early days of the marriage were so productive. They were so idyllic. And Plath later told a friend that when the marriage ended, it was like a lost Eden. People sort of tend to focus on the end of the marriage, which was indeed terrible. But the beginning was so fruitful for them as a couple. And I think he is somebody who, this is going to sound awful, but gave her permission, and I put that in quotes, to write in a much bolder way and to kind of inhabit this more raw and even violent voice. Because I think at the time, at Smith College, she'd been writing these meticulous new critical poems where she really showed off her skill with language, her skill with meter and forms. But she herself felt that she was trapped inside what she later called a glass caul, C-A-U-L. She wanted to sort of break out of what she considered almost a too tidy, too formal way of writing poetry. And then she meets Ted Hughes and all of his friends at Cambridge, and they want to shock British poetry out of submission. They're trying to write in this new way. They want to write like D.H. Lawrence. They want to write like Yeats. So they're rebelling from the current, you know, genteel verse that's popular in the day. And I think they inspire Plath to do the same. They were going out there first, and she really recognized something in their poetry that she wanted in her own verse, something aesthetic, right? And so she felt like, okay, here's a path that I can follow.
I was listening to an interview with them both where they were saying, well, especially Plath was saying that they wrote lots and lots of poems to and about each other during that very short courtship, but much less so after they actually got married. And I think Plath says that the marriage actually freed them to write about other subjects.
Yes, I think so. So many of the poems Plath wrote in the early days of the courtship were about Hughes. But then she goes off in her own direction a bit more after the marriage. And this was, you know, this idea was in the air in the mid-50s of sort of breaking away from the kind of safe, genteel verse that was then dominating British poetry. She wrote lots of letters to people, especially her mother, talking about how she and Hughes were actually positioning themselves and that they were going to sort of lead the charge in the sense. So she really did feel like she was part of something different, a new direction in British and American poetry. So in that sense, they were kind of a team.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Because here we are talking about her in the context of Hughes, but it is impossible to discuss really either of them without, you know, looking at the context of both. Because obviously Hughes is vilified as a brutal, oppressive, powerful character. He crushed Sylvia. But I was intrigued by the kind of domestic detail in your book that they actually struck me as quite advanced on the things like shared childcare, and that he was deliberately looking after the kids that they went on to have quite rapidly so that she could work on her poetry. That was a completely untraditional model for the time, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And again, many of the women I interviewed who had known Plath and Hughes in Cambridge or London at the time, they all mentioned this. They all kept saying, we were astonished by the fact...
He was changing nappies, wasn't he?
He changed nappies.
Wow.
That would always come up in the interviews, and they'd say, you have to understand, men did not do that in the 50s. They divided their time. So Plath would write in the morning, and he would take care of the baby, and then he would take over in the afternoon. And Plath really liked that schedule. She said she felt like she did her best work in the morning and that she could kind of face anything, right, after she'd had her 4 or 5 hours of writing time, alone time. And this was quite progressive for the time. I think when they had their second child, that's when things started to get more complicated. This schedule was harder to maintain because now she had 2 young children who were clamoring for her. She was breastfeeding, right? So that just makes it a little bit harder to get that uninterrupted time hours, as I know. So, but they tried. I would say the early years of the marriage were, idyllic in some ways.
Because she seems to have had pretty clear views about, I mean, she was a feminist, she had clear views that were not entirely to chime with perhaps some of the feminists of her own generation, that being a creative person didn't necessarily mean you couldn't do marriage and raising your children. And she had a very, what we think of now as a very highly evolved idea that she wanted to do all those things, that there was creativity in all of it, and she didn't want to swap one for the other. And of course, she needed him to make that possible, didn't she? As we know, those of us who've had kids and done creative work, you need assistance because there just aren't enough hours in the day to do it. And they did do that.
Yes, no, absolutely. For me, Plath's feminism is what you just said, this idea that she should not have to choose between a family and a literary life, that she could have it all. She wanted the children. She wanted to be a wife.
She had strong views about marriage, didn't she? Committed marriage.
Yes, very committed. She had a Laurentian view of marriage. This was a sacred thing. This was not a Bloomsbury view of marriage.
Because it could sound a bit like that, couldn't it? It could sound this kind of bohemian, easy come, easy go, but it wasn't that at all.
It wasn't. It was, you know, this is sacred. This is my partner for life. And the most respected women, American women poets of the day were people like Marianne Moore and Elizabeth Bishop, who were not married and who did not have children. And they sort of, there was a distance to them. They seemed to be on this rarefied plane with the men. And and I think Plath and also some of her fellow female poets like Anne Sexton and Maxine Cumin. Maxine Cumin later said that she just could not identify with poets like Moore and Bishop because they didn't lead these messy lives of struggle, having to deal with children and how do I find time to write? And she just felt like Plath was someone who had had those struggles and to whom she could relate more. So Plath was, I think, a model for other women poets in that sense.
But as you hinted, things became more vexed with more children and the marriage started to sour.
Yes, I think that after Plath's second child was born, the structure of the days began to break down. She didn't have as much time to write. By this time, they had moved to North Taunton in Devon, and they were a few hours from London, and she really started to miss the cultural life of London. And I think Hughes did too, despite the fact that he loved being able to fish, you know, and walk on the moors and that sort of thing. I think they both started to feel a bit isolated out there in Devon. And there were friends from London visited, and Hughes began an affair with Ossia Wevel. And so, yeah, I mean, things just sort of collapsed, which is sad because that move was supposed to have been something that would have brought them closer. For so long, they had dreamed about a real house. They'd lived in these tiny apartments for years and years where, you know, they had to bend over because they were both so tall. They couldn't even stand straight up. So they had always, you know, longed for this big house, and they finally had it in the countryside. Everything was supposed to be wonderful. And then, of course, it all crumbles.
And is she writing good work at that time?
She is writing, but it's difficult, I think, to find the time. But she is writing good work. She wrote The Moon and the Yew Tree, for example, before the marriage ended, which I think is one of her finest poems. She wrote Three Women, which is, I think, one of the most important things she ever wrote. It's a sort of proto-feminist verse play about motherhood. I mean, she was tackling these subjects, motherhood, miscarriage, abortion, postpartum depression. She was tackling these things when women were not talking about these issues in public.
Yeah, I mean, she is grasping that thing you were talking about earlier, isn't she, of really pushing the boundaries of what poetry can be about. I mean, it is that real inflection point where, no, I'm going to talk about the experiences I've had, and these are some of them, and they're not what you would expect.
Miscarriage,
That was really wasn't it, doing that? No one was doing that.
No one. And, you know, I give Plath so much credit because she wrote a poem called Parliament Hill Fields, and it is about her miscarriage. And she read this poem on the BBC, and she talked about the fact that it was a poem about miscarriage, and she didn't leave anything to the imagination. And I just thought, my God, that's so brave.
And how did that go down with the general public?
I didn't read anything in her letters or her journal about a negative reaction to that. So, I mean, gosh, it must be one of the first poems ever read on the air about miscarriage. I'd have to do some more research.
Yeah. So she's a brave poet. but
she is.
They separate in, yes, what, 62?
Yes, it's sort of a slow moving separation. Ted Hughes leaves Court Green in July 1962 after Plath learned, without a shadow of a doubt, that he was having an affair with Asya Wevel. And he lived in London with various friends, and he sort of went back and forth. But the marriage began to dissolve, I would say, in July of 1962, although she still hoped that they could reconcile. And a lot of their friends said, listen, it's a bourgeois affair. He'll get over it. It's no reason to end the marriage. You know, this happens, right? But for Plath, this was just, you know, the end of the world. He had betrayed her and this sacred union. You know, D.H. Lawrence was a real touchstone for both of them. And so she just felt like he was a different person almost after he started seeing other women. And despite their best attempts to reconcile, they went to Ireland together in September of 1962. These attempts did not work.
Didn't go well, did it?
No.
What is amazing is the astonishing creative flowering she had at that time, which is not what you might think. You would imagine you'd be preoccupied with single parenting and your potential divorce and all this stuff. And she is writing astonishing poetry at that time.
She is. And she's like, I think I compare it in the book to Keats, this enormous poetic outpouring. I think in 2 months she wrote more poems than she had in the previous year. And a lot of it is fueled by anger, rage at Hughes.
Yeah.
No doubt about it, right? She's riding the waves of your fury, and everything is grist for Plath's mill. I mean, she did not waste any emotion. She's trying to use that, I think, use that energy, even that anger. It brings something out of her as a poet. And she, you know, she's one of the poets that introduces female anger into the poetic lexicon. And it's another sort of brave thing that she does in some of those Ariel poems. She starts to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to write because she doesn't have any help now, right? Hughes is gone, so...
Childcare's a constant theme, isn't it?
Constant theme. And I need a nanny.
Yeah.
She moves to London in December of 1962, partly because she feels too isolated in the country, but also because she'll have an easier time getting an au pair in London. She needs help.
So she's writing Daddy, which you talked about earlier, didn't you?
Yes.
Tulips, Lady Lazarus.
Lady Lazarus, Ariel, you know, some of her most famous poems she wrote in the fall of 1962. He leaves for good on, I think it's October 11th of 1962. And then she writes Daddy a few days later, maybe even the next day, I can't quite remember. And then she writes, you know, Lady Lazarus and Purda and Fever 103 Degrees and all of these, the poems that really made her name.
But they didn't go down well, did they? I mean, we think they're astonishing work now, but she was submitting them for publication and she was getting knocked back, wasn't she?
Yeah, I think they were just too shocking for some of the editors at the time. You know, the editor of The New Yorker, Howard Moss, who had been accepting a lot and publishing a lot of her poems.
Yeah.
I think he just balked at them. This, you know, you could not publish Daddy, Daddy, you bastard, I'm through.
But she was very established, wasn't she? And I was really amazed by this. She was published all sorts of places, but this stuff, no one would touch it, would they?
No, she was so successful. She had a what's called a first reading contract with The New Yorker. So they had first dibs on anything that she would write. And this was a coveted thing to have, you know, if you were a poet in the 50s and 60s. So she was really at the top of her game. And but these poems, she kept getting rejections and she kept getting knocked back. Now, some editors did accept some of them. Her old boyfriend, Peter Davison, accepted some of the B poems for The Atlantic. So she wasn't, you know, howling in the wilderness. And Al Alvarez in London was also accepting some of these poems in The Observer. But for the most part, I think they were too shocking.
I think that was one of the things that, having studied Sylvia Plath at school and university and all that kind of thing, I never really realised the extent to which her later works were just not appreciated at all when they were first published. And I just found that really interesting to know the extent to which it was massively underappreciated, I think.
And terrible for her, because, you know, her marriage is dying, isn't it? And then that she's writing this work, which is really pushing the boundaries creatively of her. And you know, people don't want it.
Yes, because she cared so much about publication. Always, always, throughout her life, it was a marker, right, of success. She sent her poems to Boston newspapers when she was 8, 9, 10. So this is someone who really cares about getting her work published. And so when she's getting these rejection letters from the New Yorker over and over and over again, passing on some of what I think are the greatest poems of the 20th century, yeah, that fuels the depression. So all of these things combine in the winter of 1962, 1963. And of course, the bell jar is rejected in America.
The bell jar. Because obviously the bell jar, I mean, it's kind of totemic book, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And I was fascinated, I think Anna was too, and Hattie, about reading how dismissive she was of it herself. I mean, she called it in a letter to her mum a potboiler.
She did, yes.
And that did make us wonder whether there's been a lot of stuff loaded onto the bell jar that perhaps, you know, wasn't quite what Sylvia had in mind when she wrote it. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question, because for so long she had been struggling to write a novel, and she had started a novel before The Bell Jar, which was about her Cambridge years, and it was supposed to be a kind of a peon to Hughes, but she ended up burning that manuscript, according to her mother. And then finally, in the spring of 1961, she undergoes an appendectomy. And I think that this experience in the hospital, it sort of unlocks all of these earlier memories from her time at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, where she recovered after her breakdown. And she starts writing The Bell Jar not too long after, and she finishes it by August of 61. She wanted to make money. She wanted to make her name as a fiction writer. So when she says it's a potboiler, I think part of her was definitely interested in writing a bestseller. And, you know, she was not someone who just wanted to write this kind of esoteric novel that very few people would appreciate. She wanted to keep people turning the pages.
So less a creed de coeur than a kind of practical choice.
A bit of both.
But we should say, actually, for people who haven't read The Bell Jar, it's about the experience of isolation people feel when you're suffering breakdown, isn't it, really? A quick summary. I mean, what's it about, Heather?
It is set in the summer of 1953. And it is about a young woman, a very literary, ambitious young woman. It's about her experience working as an intern at a woman's magazine. She has a breakdown. She attempts suicide. She recovers. She undergoes shock treatment, which in the first instance is very traumatic for her. You know, there are a lot of flashbacks about her earlier life with her boyfriend and why her boyfriend is unsatisfactory, her complicated relationship with her mother.
And all this is Sylvia, isn't it? I mean, this is all exactly the stuff that she has experienced herself.
Yes, it's very autobiographical, right? But it's not a memoir, because people in real life are merged into different characters. And she makes very sophisticated stylistic and narrative choices about how she structures the book. And I think she's answering back to James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. And she's sort of writing her own Portrait of the Artist as a Young Woman.
Okay.
But it's a much sort of darker story. There's a darkness to it. And I can't help but think that, you know, she's commenting upon just how difficult it is for literary and ambitious women to kind of break out.
Yeah, and The Bell Jar is a distorting lens, isn't it?
Yes, and Esther, the heroine of the novel, talks a lot about this feeling of the bell jar descending, this sort of metaphor of depression, the claustrophobia of depression. And after she has her shock treatments, she says the bell jar lifts. And the novel ends on a bit of a high note, because we know that Esther has since married, she's had a baby, she seems to have found literary success. So there's a slightly happy ending, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's ambiguous. I still think it's ambiguous.
Hattie, Anna, what do you think? I think you both read it, haven't you?
Yeah, and I completely agree with, there's a lot of foreshadowing. It begins with this darkness, but and that goes through even when she's at these fancy parties and then they all get wiped out with food poisoning. And horrendous.
It's quite dark, yeah.
You really get a sense that she feels very let down by the psychiatry of the time.
Yes.
Like, it's a lot darker than I remember it when I first read it when I was like 17 or so.
Yeah, I think what's so fascinating, Plath is making these really interesting thematic decisions as she writes, and to start the book with this image of electric shock. I mean, the Rosenbergs died on the electric chair, and then you know, later in the novel, Esther herself is sort of quote unquote punished by electric shock. And I think Plath is very clearly drawing a line between this idea of dissidence and subversion and it's a really dark commentary on Eisenhower's America. It's very much a Cold War novel as much as it is sort of a recovery narrative. So there's a lot.
I was just going to say, comparing how you described Plath's own experience of electroshock therapy in Red Comet, reading that section, I mean, I had tears in my eyes because her first treatment, it wasn't supposed to be like that.
Yes.
It wasn't supposed to feel that painful, and the way in which she was traumatized by it, and obviously what she ended up drawing on for the bell jar. Now, looking back at that, having read a real description of what happened to Plath herself, I don't know, it kind of makes it all the more devastating, I think.
Yeah, they didn't use proper anesthesia the first time she had electroconvulsive therapy, and that was completely traumatic for her. She told a friend, if that ever happens to me again, I'd rather die. You know, I don't want a life of being subjected to that. It was very hard for me at the end of the book, when I was writing those last chapters, to kind of disentangle Plath's depression from the treatment and the drugs, and, you know, were the drugs making her feel worse? I know they were supposed to make her feel better, but, and then the thought of going into an institution and possibly having to experience more shock treatment. So I think she was very scared. She says it in her last letter to her psychiatrist. She says, I'm terrified of lobotomies and mental hospitals. She says it herself.
Yeah, and that's the terrible tragedy, reading that terrible convergence of events in that last winter. The weather is terrible, the kids seem to be constantly ill, she's ill, she's got no childcare, she's living in some pokey little flat in London.
Yeah.
It all sounds grim. She's really looking divorce in the eye at that point, isn't she?
Yeah.
And then there's the mental health, it are quite unsurprising, mental health issues come rolling back in, she's on the wrong medication. And you're left with a sense of when she finally kills herself in this very orderly way, and she makes very neat arrangements about what's going to happen with the kids so that they don't find her, and for Ted Hughes and letters and messages to people to call the doctor, and when they find her body and all this stuff, and it's all very organised.
Mm-hmm.
She's bringing some control into this terrible chaos.
Yes.
You just feel, if only she had had the sort of mental health services that she could have today, we wouldn't have lost her.
Yes, it's part of the tragedy. Her doctor was trying to get her a bed in a mental health facility on the Friday before she took her own life. He was calling around hospitals, and she was due to go into a hospital on the Monday or the Tuesday, and he thought, okay, the weekend, you know, she's with her children.
It'll be all right.
She's staying with friends. It'll be all right. But, I mean, it was just missed by a hair.
I mean, so many what-ifs about that.
Right.
But the overriding thing that there is a lot less of now, the shame of it all. Because, I mean, even her mother, she doesn't really want people to know that her daughter's having mental health difficulties at any stage in life, does she? It's all quite embarrassing.
Yeah.
And she doesn't like it being referred to, even after Sylvia's death.
Yes, and a lot of people did not know, you know, the weeks after her death. The line was that she had died from pneumonia. I interviewed Plath's neighbor in Wellesley. He was a boy when she had her first breakdown and she was being driven to these local mental health facilities for outpatient shock therapy. And his mother was the one who actually drove them for the procedure. And he said there was such a huge stigma that it was almost like it poisoned the entire neighborhood.
Wow.
That there was so much shame. So yeah, I think mother and daughter didn't necessarily have the language to talk about mental illness. And that's part of the tragedy.
So all her paperwork lands up with Hughes. And quite a lot of her work is published after her death.
Yes. Her most important work was published after her death. Ariel was published in 1965 by Faber and Faber, and Hughes was at the helm of that. But of course, he changed the order of her original Ariel manuscript, and that was very controversial. Frieda Hughes, Plath and Hughes's daughter, she reissued Plath's version of Ariel in 2004, I believe. So we have both versions now. In the Bell Jar, that was published in January of 1963, only a few weeks before her suicide. And of course, after her death, the Bell Jar began to gain traction.
I mean, what's your feeling, Heather? Do you share the view that he was largely to blame for Sylvia's death or not?
I think it's so complicated and so hard to untangle all of the strands. Yes, things were not ideal, but, you know, she had suffered from depression since she was a teenager. She had attempted suicide at 19. I don't blame one person, and I don't blame her mother either. Her mother's often cast as a villain in this story.
Yes.
I wanted to highlight just the complexity of
yes,
it.
Yes, more nuanced view.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was just fascinating to hear you talk about Sylvia. I've learned loads. I've really enjoyed the book. I know Hattie and Anne did too. Thank you. Will you stay with us and give us a book recommendation in a moment?
Yes, absolutely.
Slightly Foxed is a publishing house based in East London. It was founded by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. The team began publishing a quarterly magazine about all those great books on publishers' backlists that can be so hard to find in bookshops. They also reissue out-of-print books they think deserve a new generation of readers. Everything they publish is beautifully produced, from their pocket-sized cloth-bound hardbacks to illustrated collectible editions for children. Posted out to subscribers in 80 countries, the magazine itself is a collection of readable and entertaining articles about all sorts of books, fiction and non-fiction. The contributors are equally varied. Some are distinguished writers, journalists or academics, while others come from very different walks of life. Now, after 17 years, the Fox team still love finding new readers, so the annual subscription to the magazine is very reasonably priced. Even better, your subscription gives you free access to the searchable digital archive. Sign up for an annual subscription at foxquarterly.com, or if you'd rather speak to a person, give the London office a call on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Okay, book recommendations now. Anna, I'm going to come to you first.
So I've recently read a new publication called The Weak Spot by Lucy Elvin. It's published by Prototype. It's about a young woman who arrives in a remote, cloistered mountaintop town somewhere in Europe. You can get there by an old funicular. And she becomes an apprentice to a pharmacist called August Malone. And it's about her relationship with this August Malone, who is seen as the town patriarch. He is running this business in this small place, which gives him a huge amount of power because he's getting all of this information about all of these townspeople who are coming to the pharmacy with all of their ailments and things. And he manipulates it to his advantage and creates all of these dramas and melodramas. And then he ends up running for mayor because he's using his power to get more power. That's the essential kind of narrative. But it's a very strange mix of an almost fable-like story. Uh-huh. With townspeople bringing their worries through the pharmacy's doors and looking for healing. But at the same time, it feels very much like a contemporary workplace novel, this narrator finding her feet and her confidence within the professional hierarchies of this pharmacy. And
it sounds like an odd juxtaposition, if I'm honest, Anna.
I did find it quite destabilising at times. And the events unfold in quite surprising ways, and there's like rumours flying around. August Malone is undermining her confidence all the time, but while the narrator keeps her feelings very still, it's like very even keeled and quite eerie. It was quite an odd one, but I would recommend it. It feels incredibly modern. So yeah.
Okay. Heather, what have you got for us?
Well, I'm interested in group biography right now, and I just read a brilliant group biography called Gods of the Upper Air by Charles King. It's about anthropologists. It's about Franz Boas and his students, Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict and Zora Neale Hurston. And it's all about their lives and their work. And for those of you who have read Lily King's novel Euphoria, which is about Margaret Mead, I think you'll enjoy Gods of the Upper Air. And then I'm in the middle of Mary Gabriel's Ninth Street Women, about women abstract expressionists. It's a tome. It's about 1,000 pages or so. And I think it took her almost 20 years to write, but it's all about like Lee Krasner and Elaine de Kooning and some of the more prominent female expressionists and their lives and their contributions to American art in the 50s. I'm in the middle of that right now. I'm really enjoying it.
Thanks, Heather. Hattie, what have you got for us?
Well, I was wondering whether, before I do my book recommendation, I could just do a quick podcast recommendation as well.
Oh, yeah.
Basically, when I was preparing for this podcast, I listened to an interview that Heather gave as part of a conversation with Sophie Oliver and Peter Mackay on the Arts and Ideas podcast for BBC Three with Shahida Bari, and they talked brilliantly about Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath and Seamus Heaney, and I just thought that episode was really great.
Absolutely.
And I learned a lot. On the book front, it's a bit of a cheat, but I finally had the chance to read our special publication for winter. It's Letters to Michael, A Father Writes to His Son, 1945 to 1947. It's a collection of letters that a man called Charles Philipson wrote to his son. Charles's granddaughter is, in fact, the artist Heather Philipson. And Heather started sharing these illustrated letters on Instagram via an account called Sketches from Space. And we sent the account to Gail and Hazel, and they loved the letters so much. And we're very privileged to be able to publish it. It's just a brilliant collection of 150 letters, all illustrated, just Charles going about his day, encouraging Michael to learn to read. They're sort of scrawled on office paper and done in tea breaks and lunch breaks. His mother kept all of them, and thank goodness she did. They're very short and sweet, and it's just, I think, probably the perfect Christmas present. A real tonic for these times, I think.
I remember you saying you were going to mention this book in the podcast. We've got some clips, I think.
That's right.
A couple of the letters voiced up by a great friend of Slightly Fox, the actor Nigel Anthony.
May the 8th, 1945. Dear Michael, hooray, hooray! This is a day you will always remember. This is VE Day. Now you can light your lamps. Love from Daddy. XXX. April the 26th, 1946. My dear Michael, do you remember the little boy in the film Swiss Family Robinson and how he rode an ostrich? Would it not be very exciting if you could ride to school on one? We should have to let it sleep in the garage. Love from Daddy. XXX. November the 7th, 1946. My dear Michael, oh, the magic of a bonfire. The fiery glow, the dancing sparks, the curling orange-coloured flames, the floating, billowing smoke clouds, the showers of firework sprays against the dark blue sky. Is it any wonder that everyone loves a rippling, crackling bonfire? Love from Daddy. XXX.
Now, Anna, you've got another Book Lovers Day trip for us. Where is it?
Today we are heading to the National Poetry Library on the fifth floor of the Royal Festival Hall on the South Bank Centre in London. This library houses reference and loan copies of poetry from 1912 onwards, meaning that it's the largest public collection of modern poetry in the world, containing over 200,000 items. And they, well, when they can, acquire two copies, one for reference and the second copy for loan to the public.
Yeah, I mean, that's the nice thing. It is a proper library. You can go, you can join and you can borrow books.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's free to join as well, crucially. As long as you've got a form of ID, you can just go and sign up to become a member. You can also join online membership.
Thanks very much, Anna. And we're done, I think, for this month. We'll be back in December when we have a very appropriate episode lined up for the festive season. I am saying no more about that right now. Do not miss it. In the meantime, you'll find all the books and writers we mentioned in the show notes. Foxquarterly.com is the web address where you'll find all sorts of good things. But until next month, thanks for listening and for joining us on another literary trek off the beaten track.